The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum from Accelerated Government Strategies, providing advisory consulting for innovative startups to help grow government revenue. Every week, Aileen and Gigi welcome Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives who are taking risks to engineer success and shape the future. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now your hosts, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today in the studio, we have Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period. Courtney is a recognized expert in business development and corporate growth. She has a widespread experience in both public and private sector and is a sought-after speaker on a broad range of business and leadership issues.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, Courtney, let's start with your current role. You're CEO of Growth Period. What does Growth Period do?
We are a business development firm. We help companies grow. We help them win work with other commercial entities or with governmental entities around the world. We like to refer to ourselves as professional killers, not eaters. We help you win it, but we don't want to run it.
And so who are some of your typical clients?
Our clients include companies like MAG Aerospace, Nemacol and Woodland Resorts, Stanley Black & Decker has been a client, Stream, Team Fouria. We could keep going. There's a lot of them.
So when I think about business development, I think about connections and connecting people to opportunities and vice versa. Is that what you do?
We are revenue generators. So there's a difference between business development and sales, and we do business development, which leads to revenue growth, right? So we're the R and the ROIC. We get the return. So it does involve connecting people, but we're not just door openers. We're door openers with the intent to close with revenue. So we don't do photo ops with, you know, big decision makers. We work at the level where people make contractual decisions.
So, Courtney, I was reading a little bit about your background, and I saw certainly a straight line is not how I describe your career. Very fascinating turns. I saw in 2009, after you started Growth Period, like 2 years after, you acquired Potomac Recruiting. Why acquire a recruiting company?
Well, we acquired it because a lot of our clients were asking us to just help them find someone, just help us find a good business developer, just help us find a good capture manager, just help us find the right program manager. And, you know, we're not a charitable organization. So we figured we had enough demand that we would monetize it. And we went and worked with a woman that I had known for a long time whose company and ethics mirrored ours. We're very big into ethics. And she really had a different approach to recruiting and has very strong metrics of success. And it really fit our culture. So we bought them.
You said you have a very strong ethics culture. Tell us what that means.
Well, in our firm, we do bi-yearly compliance training, and we bring in a law firm, Akin Gump, to do it. And it's currently just dozens of modules that revolve from Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, revolving door rules, securities laws. But even more than that, from the very beginning, and we're 10 years old this year, which is exciting, we've had a corporate social responsibility practice where we pay for all of our employees to do 8 hours of community service a year. It's actually reflected on their annual review. I try and lead by example by being involved in a lot of nonprofit activities. So I think ethics works both ways. First and foremost, we make sure we're legally compliant. And then secondarily, we encourage our employees to have a personal sense of giving back.
So what does a business development company do?
We actually develop leads or strategic plan or lateral growth plans for companies that want to achieve revenue growth. So if you're a company that's growing in A and you want to grow in B and C and D, we help you figure out how. We put together the plan for you, and then we work with you to execute it all the way through deal signature.
Today, we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO of Growth Period. Courtney, I'm going to completely change directions on you here and talk about your personal journey. Where did you grow up? What was your family like?
Well, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I think my family journey was a little bit more complicated than the average person. When I was about 20, my father went to federal prison for a series of white-collar crimes, and my mom worked in retail, and I was an only biological child, so I was left with sort of all the bills and the responsibility, and was a senior at University of Pennsylvania, so I got the bill for that too. And you know, I think historically that wasn't really what I had as an experience with my family. We had been close up until that point, so it completely unraveled and really taught me the importance of having a vision, persevering towards it and having a personal sense of strength, because it was a very unfortunate time for everyone involved. And as somebody who was so young, I was determined to chase my dream, which was to work in national security. And this was in the 90s, and there weren't a lot of jobs in national security, and there weren't any real high-paying jobs in national security. And so I moved down here because I was given an opportunity to work at the White House and really catered and waitressed and taught SAT and did everything I needed to do to pursue my dream but still eat.
When I heard you just tell the story, I'm struck by the fact that you just were talking about how important it is for you to have an ethical company, and then your dad went to prison for white collar crimes. Is there a direct line causality connection between those two things?
I think without a doubt, it shapes my desire to always do things completely appropriately. You know, I never want to be associated with him in that way.
How did that event shape you? I mean, obviously, financially, I'm sure it had took a huge toll. But you said you were close before. Did that cause you to have a falling out with your father? Did you then have to look at him in a different way? Are you still close to him today?
No, we have no relationship. And in terms of how I viewed things, I was raised by my family and educationally to have a personal sense of integrity. And so I was able to look at my father at the time. Things rapidly deteriorated to the point where we don't have a relationship and I don't want to have one, where I was able to say, I love you, but what you did was wrong. I didn't make excuses for it. I didn't pretend it didn't happen. I didn't endorse a policy of denial. In fact, I felt very strongly that he should take responsibility for what he had done, and it caused a very big rift between us. So I think sometimes as a parent, you have to be careful what you ask for. If you raise somebody to have a strong sense of ethic and a strong sense of right and wrong and personal integrity, and then that's what you get, you really shouldn't be surprised.
What an amazing strength. I can just feel it from you, learning from something that some people would have not took such a positive turn from a course of events. What do you think was the internal fortitude that helped you realize how to become better out of a situation that maybe most other people would get pulled down?
You know, I've given that thought over the years, because as I've become a parent, I've given thought to what can I learn from what I went through that helped shape my character in a good way, and what would I want differently from my own children, experientially aside, right, character building wise. And I think there were a myriad of factors that went into how I was able to react to it. Some of it, I think, is I'm a redhead, so it's just genetically tough, right? Some of it is that I went to a preparatory school for my entire education up until college that had religious education. And though I was a different religion than the preparatory school was, we went three times a week to chapel. And really, it was more secular than it was religious, but they talked a lot about right and wrong and work ethic and the importance of, you know, being a good Christian. And I'm not Christian, but I'm Jewish. So, but it really resonated with me, the idea of to whom much is given, much is expected. And I think that really also played a role in it. And I think I read a lot growing up, and a lot of what I read back then, I think books have changed and you know, things have changed in the world today. There were very black and white sort of lessons about ethics in a lot of the literature that I read, and it made an impression on my imagination and then on my character.
So you brought up parenting before. So how has it shaped the way You have a 14-month-old, right?
I have a 27-year-old, a 21-year-old, and a 14-month-old, because my husband is a widower, so I've helped raise his children for the last several years.
So how has it helped shape the way that you deal with your kids or helping them see the path?
With my daughter, who's 21, I've tried very hard to explain to her that it's not what happens in life that matters, it's how you deal with it. When she was just about 11, her mother died from an accident in a hospital. And my daughter is also adopted, so I'm her third mother, so to speak. And she's incredibly well adjusted. You would never know. She's very strong, extremely fabulous. And I think I've spent a lot of time explaining to her that everybody has their stuff, right? And you can't use it as an excuse to not go through life and persevere and do your best. And I think that the culture of being a victim has become very, you know, popular in the world today. And the world is even harder than it was when I was growing up, with the social media and all the pressures. And it's so much more expensive now for our children than it was for us to buy our first residence. And I explained to her, I think, very consistently that there's nothing you can do about this reality. That's the way life is. So what are you going to do to make your day better? What are you going to do to get ahead? And how are you going to rely on yourself and your education and your sense of personal identity to understand that you're going to have all these obstacles and you've got to persevere? I also think I've tried to explain to her that as a woman, things aren't the same as for my son, who's 27, or my other son, who's 14 months, that there still is differentials, some positive, but still a lot negative. And that as a millennial, it's very important, because they're very about work-life balance, that she not give up the fight for the grounds that we've gained as the generations above them in the name of, I want balance, so it doesn't matter if I make partner, you know, because it's more important to me that I have balance, and that, you know, she has a responsibility not just to herself, but to others, to do the right thing.
Today, we're speaking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO of Growth Period. Coming up, we'll ask Courtney about her early career. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period. Now, Courtney, and when I was doing research, I read an article about you in Smart CEO, and you were quoted that success in a male-dominated field has largely been driven by confidence in your own abilities. Just before, we were talking about, you know, your encouragement of your stepdaughter about her finding her own strength. Your quote was, "I'm comfortable with my femininity. I love wearing dresses and high heels and styling I'm here, but I balance that with extreme competence in a way that engenders respect." Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I'm definitely girly, right? I like to shop.
I love it, actually, by the way.
And I love fashion. I always have. In fact, my daughter just got published in Vogue Australia yesterday. She's interning for Vogue Australia right now over in Sydney. So I think she's gotten a lot of her interest and love for fashion from me. And I believe it's important to express your own sense of style, whatever it is. For me, I'm a particularly feminine person. I like ladylike clothes, and I prefer elegance as my style, though I can be funky, I'm sure, on weekends, whatever. And I think, you know, growing up in the defense world where I grew up in my formative years in my career, they were not yet attuned to a more feminine woman in a position of authority. Right. So I was definitely a girl from behind. You know, I definitely never got confused in the room full of men about who the woman was. And I think initially for a lot of them, that was a little bit of a paradigm shift. And I think for a long time, women felt like they had to give up their femininity. And I'm generalizing, which isn't fair, but, you know, cut their hair super short, wear the pantsuit. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. I own pantsuits. I prefer long hair, but there's lovely short hairstyles. But really try and look more like the men looked in the boardroom than how they really wanted to be. And I just don't do that. I don't compromise who I am because it will make me look more like sheep, if that makes sense.
No, I love it. Your confidence. I'm a little older than you and started out in mid-80s. And I can remember women, my coworkers, cigars were a big thing back then. Who would sit there and smoke cigar. Mm-hmm. And there are some women that love cigars, but these are not women that love cigars. But it seemed to be the thing to do to connect. But you seem to have found a really nice balance of being able to be yourself and be very strong in your own skin.
Apparently, you came to this comfort with being both feminine and also playing in a male-dominated world pretty early in your life to make that choice. How did you decide to major in national security?
So my graduate degree was in the School of National Security, but my undergraduate major was military history, which is almost the same thing, but slightly different. And when I was in third grade, there was a mini series on TV called The Winds of War, and it really captured my imagination. And in particular, I liked the idea of working with the military who, it seemed to me, had a lot of really ideal jobs available, and you could give back to your nation, you could serve something larger than yourself, and it was dynamic. You weren't always behind a desk. You got to see the world. And I never really lost that focus as I continued my educational career.
We have to give more girls images of people that look like themselves, show them more images of people that look like themselves. So again, I'm kind of struck by the fact that you weren't dissuaded, even seeing this miniseries, you weren't dissuaded when you were studying military history. I got to imagine you were the only girl in the room a lot of times.
It worked out well for my social life. But yes, no, I wasn't dissuaded by the absence of female role models. In fact, there were very few when I did this. It was in the early 90s, and there was no yet. Hillary Clinton was the first lady, and Madeleine Albright wasn't yet 68. There really was like Jean Kirkpatrick, and that was it. So I looked back in history for other role models, like an Amelia Earhart, like, an Indira Gandhi, people who really had achieved things despite the prevalence of the word no from the people around them. I remember when I was graduating college, I went to my best friend's father and was talking to him about the fact that I had been offered an internship at the White House and that I was moving to Washington. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you're too smart to work in the government. That'll never last, right? And it's been 20 years. I don't work in the government or even really remotely with national security anymore. But I remember being sort of horrified by that and thinking, what kind of advice is that to give to a young woman who's going into a non-traditional field? Why don't you be more encouraging of that and say, oh, that's great that you have that interest, and encourage it? And really in the early to mid-90s, my interest in national security was just weird to a lot of people. It wasn't avant-garde or isn't that great. And then after 9/11, all those people wanted me to come to their backyard barbecues and talk about my experiences at the Pentagon or the White House. And so there was a really big cultural shift.
Today we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period. Courtney, you started Growth Period at a difficult economic time. It was kind of a unique choice and time to start. What made you want to start a company at such a turbulent time?
Well, if I had to do it all over again, I'm not sure that I would start a services company. But starting a services company at that time, I would say I benefited from the absence of foreshadowing. I just didn't have an awareness of how bad it was going to get, right? So it was 07, which was kind of really right before it got truly terrible. And I think there was a demand in the market that allowed us to succeed regardless of the economic circumstance. But certainly looking back, I can't believe I had the courage to do it and the fortitude to sustain it.
So earlier you had mentioned that since the inception of your company, you require or ask employees to give hours to community service. Now, at a turbulent time, you started a company and you weaved that into the very foundation of your organization. Do you think that's helped build a culture and success based on that kind of, it is weaved into the very fabric of what your organization does?
So the number one reason I started the company was because I wanted to create a culture that I could control that wasn't predicated on the emotion of fear. I felt very strongly that corporate America was headed towards a blanket culture of fear-driven behavior, where it wasn't the intent behind the mistake that mattered, it was the mistake itself. And I wanted to have a culture where employees, regardless of their age, they could be, some of our employees are in their 70s, some are early 20s, felt like they could learn and grow and contribute and have that sense of team even when they make mistakes, not despite when they make mistakes. So we teach our employees from the very beginning that it's not the mistake that matters, it's the intent. And I think that goes hand in glove with having the community service aspect of it. So I do think we have a nice culture. We've historically had very high retention, which I think is great. But I also think that it's a reflection of really who we are. And I'm not sure we could have done it differently.
So at this time also, this is right when everything was happening on Wall Street. There was plenty of Wolf of Wall Street movies. That was glamorized, that kind of activity. And I'll put it in a different way. The ends always seems to, at that time, justify the means. And so you really turned that around. You've taught the other side of that.
Well, I'm not sure that in history that's really ever been different. It's just maybe the press attention and then, of course, the big historical recession, which is, obviously a major moment in the world's history. And that only comes so many times, throughout since the Industrial Revolution. So that is notable. But I think human nature is what it is. Right. And so you're going to have greed and you're going to have avarice and you're going to have opportunism and you're going to have people who are more altruistic. And the question is, who do you want to be?
I'm seeing a kind of a pattern here where you get inspired by something and then take action, right? So you were inspired to start a company because you wanted a different kind of corporate culture that you saw in America writ large. You start this company, you start it right before the recession. How did you get clients in those early days? Was it, you know, tell us a little bit about, were you lucky enough to have a lot of clients right from the beginning, or were there some bumps in that early road?
So we were lucky enough to have clients from the very beginning, and from day one through today, which is 10 years later, because we haven't really advertised, we've never had a PR firm. It's all been word of mouth based on our work product. And so as our work product grew, right, in terms of volume and complexity, our client base grew. And I think like anything else, if you provide quality, you do have a tendency to get a bit more quantity. I do think that we have been hampered historically by not initially being backed by some kind of capital raise, right? I started the company with money from my own pocket. Last year, we did raise growth capital, but not a lot, just some. And it took me a long time to really understand that world. So I think one of the things that's really a gap for women entrepreneurs is the financial education about the resources available and the different structures, you know, mezzanine debt, all these different things that I think a lot of people act like they were born knowing. And I wasn't. Right. So I spent 2 years of my life as an entrepreneur really going around to everybody else I knew and asking questions about what is debt? What does a PE investor do for you? What about VC? What are the travails? What are the positives? And I think that that period of time could have been shortened by more financial education available to female entrepreneurs. And I still think 10 years later, right, that it's lacking.
You know, I think you are 100% correct. Both Aileen and I have a background coming out of Silicon Valley, and it is well documented that it is so much harder for women entrepreneurs to raise capital, that is still sort of the ultimate glass ceiling that women have a hard time breaking through. So what do you think the solution is? You mentioned more education. Is that, I mean, that's part of it, I'm sure, but how else do we fix that problem?
Well, this is not a short answer from my perspective. I'll do my very best to be concise. But I do believe that, first of all, women have to stop paying lip service to other women. Angel funding is great. $25,000 gets me nothing. Right. So it's a little bit like the old fashioned days where women would get together and have a circle of friends. And I'm not saying we shouldn't lean in. I do believe in leaning in. In fact, I'm very much a believer in women must help other women, which drives this point of if you are in the position to start a venture fund or a PE fund or a debt fund and you are a woman, why aren't you looking at gearing it just towards women and women entrepreneurs, and especially early stage ones, and marrying it with educational requirements, not just a 40-page form that you have to fill out and 4 levels of interviews, but the idea that, you know, maybe a services company from a valuation perspective is different from a product one, which is different from a tech one. And for me, I didn't know that. When, you know, my daughter says to me, what would you do differently if you could go back in time? I said, I'd start a pet food company because I'd be a billionaire by now, right? Because 10 years ago, pet food, that was, you know, kind of virgin grounds, and now it's saturated, but they sell for like 40x. I think it depends on your goals. And I had the goal to create a culture, but also to make money. And I think there's a lot less opportunity for women in the private equity world. I work with private equity clients every day. And I'm a particularly thick-skinned person, but I think that you have to be as a woman, because a lot of the vibe isn't necessarily warm and friendly. And that's fine, but I don't understand why women in that position don't do more that's realistic. And again, I'm not knocking the $25,000 angel groups. I just, as an entrepreneur myself, it doesn't do anything for me. And I think in today's world, unless you're starting a very small business, even having $125,000 in capital is nice, but after taxes and whatever, maybe you can, you know, get a little bit of your startup going, but it doesn't get you anywhere. I have structured our, to be super candid, I've structured our estate, my will, that one day, hopefully a long time from now when I pass, some of the money goes to funding women who want early stage funding for entrepreneurial businesses. And I will say that transcends back to the mantra of women on boards and women in executive positions, because I was a vice president at a defense company, right? And this was in the early millennial, when there weren't that many women. I've seen a lot of women, and I still do, who are happy to accept help but don't give it. And I actually actively work to put women on boards and actively work to help their businesses. But the reciprocity is low. And that's not why I do it. But what I do try and impart on them is you don't have to help me, but you do have to help each other. And I think that until women step up, why should the men?
Today, we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO of Growth Period. Coming up, we'll ask Courtney about women on boards. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period.
So, Courtney, we talked about so many things during that last segment, but we really talked a lot about Growth Period and you starting it. But you had a long career in the defense industry before Growth Period at you know, very well-known names like Raytheon and Lockheed, and all of which, particularly at that time, were very male-dominated organizations. So what made you go into that industry? And then what was your experience like?
Well, I went into the industry because I was a military history major with a master's degree in national security studies. So I clearly wanted to be in the aerospace defense world at that time. And especially pre-911, who was employing for that? You know, after 911, I think you got a lot of companies that were like Joe's Plumbing and Homeland Security Services. You know, but before 911, there wasn't that many options. And also, I think people forget about the Gen Xers. We're sort of the workhorse generation that is sandwiched between two generations that think they're the only ones that matter. And as Gen Xers, we really got out of school right before the tech revolution with the internet and the WWW companies. So we weren't all leaving and going to the Googles, the initial startups. We were leaving and still going to the traditional accounting firms or the banks or, you know, big defense companies. That's who the employers were. And I think people also forget there was a mini recession in the mid-90s. And so jobs weren't as prevalent as they became 3, 4, 5 years later. So you went where you had an interest and someone would hire you.
And what was your experience in those early days?
Well, certainly I was mentored by some great folks, some male, some female. But I remember joining Women of Defense and being number 85. Don't quote me. I don't want to get that wrong. But it was something below 100. And I remember thinking, wow, well, that's complicated. So, you know, in the beginning, there were a lot fewer of us. But I will say when I worked in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations Low Intensity Conflict, there were 3 other women that were very senior. I was a GS 14, I think, at the time, and I was about 25. So that was very senior for a 25-year-old. And I had 2 peers who were my age who were at least 14s, if not 15s. And I had actually 2 other women who were, one was a senior military officer and the other was an SES. So, I mean, that was a lot of women, I guess, especially for special operations, especially in the 90s. But they were very prevalent. And I'm still friends with them today. And one of them I'm still extremely close to.
Today, we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period. So, Courtney, women hold about 16% of corporate boards in the U.S., and they hold 14% of the executive officer positions, according to Catalyst Research. Just 23 of the Fortune 500 CEOs are females. Less than 4% of the boardrooms in aerospace companies are women. Courtney, with the executive positions you've held and you help with, you've really shattered the glass ceiling. Have women finally broken the old boys club, or there are things need to change?
Absolutely not. There's still a glass ceiling. There's still the old boys club. There needs to be an old girls club, right, which we sort of discussed a little bit ago. And I think any woman who tells you that there isn't a glass ceiling is not living in reality, right? And women still aren't doing enough to help other women. What I say to women on boards is, when you go to replace yourself, it's great that if you try to replace yourself with a woman, but while you're on the board, why do you see it's okay to be the only woman? Like, oh, a woman's here. Why can't there be, if there's 12 spots on the board, why can't there be 10 women? I don't understand it. So I always try and encourage women in those positions that, you know, if you have 40 people in your C-suite and 4 women, don't be excited that you have 10% women. You know, look at it and say, who's the best qualified? And am I not really looking for the women who could do that job? But I think women, very much like men, because we're all human, sort of conform to certain political norms, right, especially in a corporate environment, and it becomes unpopular to advocate for diversity in a way that isn't lip service. You know, the diversity officer, the photo on the annual report, which was really the only time I ever saw some of the other diverse people in some of the companies you mentioned, was when we all got together to be photographed for the cover of the annual report. And why do women in those positions have to always be HR or marketing or PR? Why can't they be the operations executive or the growth officer or the financial officer? And, you know, I think that's a mindset change that women have to undergo first, because if we pulled each other up and helped each other, it'd be harder to be excluded. So I know a lot of women who are very prominent, especially in Washington, D.C., who sit on boards, who are very proud of the fact that they helped one woman get on one board. And to me, that's a lot like I ate breakfast, but what are you doing the rest of the day? And so I think you're asking for a cultural shift that we're not even endorsing as a gender. And it's not fair to 100% put that on men. Not that they don't have a huge role in this, but I think very much like getting the vote, right? It has to become a movement that's more than just lean in or more than just I helped one person and so I feel good about myself. It's really about affecting actual change.
So what strategies do you use to deal with situation where you feel you're not being treated equitable? And if you have a story to share about that, we'd love to hear it.
Goodness. I would have a lot of stories about that because I'm honest, right? I think it would be more popular to say, oh, gee, let me think of one. But I have a lot of them. To pick one that I think would be effective for listeners, I mean, I have learned the hard way, right? And so what I've tried to do is be more self-aware of my learning curve and understand that I wasn't well advised when if I want to drive capital, not just do what we're great at, maybe having a services business without tech insertion wasn't the smartest vision initially. You know, and we've adapted and we've changed, but I didn't have the right mentors. In fact, I really didn't have mentors like that. I had people in national security who knew terrorism really well, who became great on CNN, but they didn't know anything about business. And so, I think you, some degree, you get treated the way you behave, right? So if you behave with confidence and intelligence, I do think it helps. I also think it helps if you don't speak when you don't know what you're talking about. So don't be the voice just to show that the woman has the voice. I also think that the younger you are, and I've always worn sunblock, so from a social angle, that's positive. I look a little younger, but from a, you know, career-wise, I'm not as young as I look. I think you really have to figure out what the culture of the room is. And is it really inherently a room that's going to enable a meritocracy or not? And if it is going to enable a meritocracy, I think you should listen before you speak and then figure out what they're valuing and how they're valuing it. And I think men do the same thing, maybe more unconsciously, but I do think they do the same thing. And I think then you have to contribute in meaningful ways and not let insecurity drive you to make mistakes that you really know you're making and that are silly.
So you've been in this business 20 plus years. Do you think it's changing?
Which part of the business?
The reception of women in the boardroom.
I think it's become much more popular to talk about it. And I think that that's a good step forward. And I think organizations like NACD, who I'm involved with a bit, are trying much harder to care about women. I do think there are bellwether women in our community who talk a lot about helping women and don't really do it. And I'm not really sure why they have that reputation. Maybe it's because they were the first woman on the board. But when I really break down what they've done to help other women, I don't get it. So on some level, I think increasing the dialogue and the awareness is always a positive, right? On another level, I feel like, however, establishing a token policy where that person becomes sort of self-centered in their ability to be the token has hurt us because they sort of feel like, oh, my job is done. I have this high-profile woman. I also feel like boards are not looking for necessarily the right kinds of women. A lot of women self-select themselves out of being a partner in a law firm or staying in a Fortune 100 world. And, you know, I always say to people, I started a small business. It wasn't a penal action, right? Like no court sentenced it to me. I chose to leave a Fortune 100 company and start a small business. Like I chose to start the business. Doesn't mean I'm less adept as a corporate person than I was. It was just a choice I made. And I think the other problem is right now, a lot of boards, and especially the recruiters who have a lot of power, and of course, you know, I'm chairman of Potomac Recruiting, so I know a little bit about this, but these recruiters have a lot of power and they really want this resume that enables 12 of the same women to get on these boards. And they're missing sort of the point of what make women special as contributors.
Today, we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period. Coming up, we'll ask Courtney how she balances it all. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You'll always learn something when you read commentary by Federal Drive anchor Tom Temin. Sign up today at federalnewsradio.com. Search alerts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today we're talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO, Growth Period.
So, Courtney, you mentioned earlier that you're a stepmom and to a 21 and 27-year-old. And by all accounts, I have to say you have a great relationship. First of all, you say my daughter, my son. But I found some of the most interesting, when I was doing research on you, writing from your daughter, who is an author, an aspiring author, and has written several pieces. And she talks about the fact that you're her hero and you're her inspiration and pieces of advice that you've given her. And you have a new baby, a 14-month-old. So, I mean, I've got so many questions to ask you about life balance. But the first one has to be, how did you step into that position as the stepmother, which is so troubling for so many families, and at least from all appearances, just like knock it out of the park?
Well, it wasn't like that initially, right? It's an evolution. And I think the important thing, and it's sort of a theme throughout my life, is to try and be honest. And then also to be independent in the sense that I let, especially our son, who was older, have his space. You know, I'm never going to be their mom. I'm never going to replace their mom. And I don't want to do that. Their mother was fabulous and she didn't leave them. She passed away due to some unfortunate circumstances. And so I remember when we got engaged, my stepdaughter, my daughter, I do call her that, came to me and said, can I call you mom now? And I said, no, honey, you call me Courtney because you had a mom and she was fabulous. And that's her title. I think that our case was a little complicated and I'm not going to really get into the details of it. There was a lot of nonsense in the community about, you know, sort of loyalty to the late mother and you know, a lot of unnecessary, really ridiculous gossip and lots of things, because I'm much younger than my husband. So naturally, I'm the scary second wife who's younger. And, you know, I'm also an earner. And it's just a very different paradigm than sort of the community in which they were living. And I think what I've tried really hard to do with them is just say, look, this is who I am and I'm going to behave a certain way and we're going to have this relationship based on respect and honesty. And if that works for you, it'll grow. And it has grown. But there were definitely bumps in the road in the beginning. My daughter and I are, I would say, very, very close. But I also think that I'm her parent and not her friend. And I think that's something that's very important. You know, I do believe that children need structure, regardless of their age, and they need rules and it helps them feel safe. And so I do provide that. I'm the one who makes things happen for them and facilitate it, but I'm also the one who says no.
There's a whole kind of set of parenting skills that you need to learn to deal with teenagers and college students and young adults. And you're a CEO. You've obviously learned those parenting skills and are doing them quite adeptly. You are very active in different charities and community activities. And, oh, by the way, you just had a baby a year ago. So now you're also learning to be a mom to a newborn. Literally, how are you balancing it all?
Well, I don't. I mean, I think anybody who sits here or sits anywhere and says, oh, I have fabulous work-life balance is in a career I'd like to learn about, or is super wealthy and has a lot of help, or is living in La La Land, right? I don't balance it. Yesterday I saw my baby for 10 minutes, right? The day before I didn't see him at all. Today I saw him for 5 minutes. I will not see him again till tomorrow. And that stinks. And where I think I get a little bit frustrated is where, you know, I'm responsible for employees and for the health of an organization. So my maternity leave was 8 days. Right. It wasn't because I was a martyr. It wasn't because I am this great career woman had to rush back to work. It's just reality. And there are millions of women who own and run small businesses who don't have a choice. You know, I'm luckier than many in the sense that we have a great nanny. I call her the baby whisperer. But I also work extremely hard to pay for her. So it's a balance, right? We're not letting our child have a nanny that was the lowest bidder. So she's expensive. And so on one hand, you could say, well, I have that luxury. On the other hand, I could say I work very hard to pay for it. I knew who I was when I decided with my husband to have a baby. And I understood I had responsibilities and a career and financial obligations. And so I made a deal with myself that I wouldn't feel guilty. And it's the same deal I make with myself with, in particular, my daughter, because my son was 16 when I really got into his life and was out of the house 2 years later. But with my daughter, she was just turning 11. And you know, I really got involved with her sort of in her teen years. I made a deal with myself and I was honest with her that I'm not going to be at every ballet recital. I'm not going to make every horse jumping show. But I am going to, and so does my husband, but I am going to pay the bills. You are not going to have to pay for college like I did. And you will go to Europe on spring break so you can see the world and understand other cultures. And it's because I and your father work super hard to make those possible. And I can't feel guilty about it. And I'm not going to put up with you making me feel guilty because this is the real world. So that's the best I can do.
Courtney, you've accomplished so many things and you brought up you're working towards that next thing. So what is next for Courtney? Let's say, you know, you hit that port. What is next for you?
It's a very fair question. Obviously, I want my business to continue to succeed and grow. Personally, I don't know, right? I think we're at the 10-year mark, which is wonderful. Growth period has done so well, and we do so well by our clients. And obviously, we'll continue to thrive and succeed, hopefully, and you know, have that be how we interact with industry. But, you know, I think you have to pivot. And so where we're going to pivot to and how that's going to affect me, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence, which we've made an investment in, or getting involved more on the growth side of funds, or, you know, something that is indescribable, but I'm reaching towards. I don't 100% have the vision that's clear. And I have tried to learn this time around and increase my mentor base so that I can talk to them about my frustrations, my challenges, my goals, my wishes, and ask them what they think that means, because I'm not sure I have the answer, and I would love someone to give it to me, but I'm not 100% sure yet.
So, Courtney, speaking about not being sure, when you were graduating, I got to ask you this question. If you were to go back in time to Courtney before you had this incredible journey of yours, what pieces of advice would you give Courtney as she went across that graduation stage?
Well, if I could talk to myself and nothing else changed, right? My life was going to be what it was going to be. I mean, I think I would say everything's going to be okay. You know, just work hard and keep your head down and get through it. And to be optimistic and to learn more about business and less about national security.
Today, we've been talking with Courtney Spaeth, CEO of Growth Period.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. Learn more about AGS and the work they do to help accelerate your business plans for public sector at excelgovstrat.com. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington, Wednesday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.